name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. With the first two 10-minute speakers, we have the Irish lineup tonight, it looks like. Irishmen and alcohol go together pretty good. In fact, the pharmacological definition of alcohol is a colorless, odorless liquid that prevented the Irish from taking over the world. The Irish contributed two things to the world. One was the word Usque Da, which in Gaelic means water of life, the origin of the word whiskey, and guilt. But the truth is, and I say this only for the benefit of those of you who come from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, they got the guilt from the Norsemen. A guy named Olaf the White founded Dublin. That's a matter of actual historical fact. And he brought with him guilt, so you can thank those Vikings for the guilt. First time I got drunk, I was about 14 years old. I drank a quart of slow gin and ate a half a pound of Spanish peanuts. And re-stucco the inside of my cousin's house. About 24 years later, I was in Ojai, California, taking a little nap on the floor of my kitchen about 4 a.m. Getting up enough rest to go into bed. And I noticed that I was vomiting straight up in the air. You know. I had drunk a quart of Morgan David wine. You know, and that little mist is drifting down in your face. I don't talk about that at breakfast meetings, only at the Pacific Group. But between those two events, quite a bit happened. And I'm not going to give you a drunk-by-drunk account of it, but I'll tell you that a lot of it was unpleasant. I can assure you of that. I'll tell you a little bit about how I got here. I was born the last of five children in a typical, normal Irish Catholic dysfunctional family near a place called Sioux City, Iowa. And that's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. We were just ordinary poor farmers. We didn't know we were poor in those days because we didn't have any federal guidelines. But we had no money. And we were very religious people, if religious means going to church a lot. And we were also God-fearing farmers, you know. You'd be God-fearing too if you had the kind of God we had. We were the God of my childhood, the God of my understanding as a child, was a lot like the Ayatollah Khomeini. And have your hands chopped off for minor infractions, a lot of which I had been committing out behind the barn, you know. And, so I learned at a very early age to get $1,000 worth of guilt out of a nickel's worth of sin. We got that from the Norsemen, too. But, I went to school and I hated every minute of it. I somehow had an aversion for authority that followed me through life up to and including this moment. And I just didn't get along in school very well. I needed approval a lot, and so I used to clown around and do all kinds of goofy things. And so when I found alcohol as a kid, you know, it enhanced my being. I felt like I could really get out there and be with people. You know, any other time I felt like, standing on one foot, digging my big toe in the hot sand and twisting my cap in my hands as a shy little kid. And alcohol did a hell of a lot for me, you know. It really made me feel comfortable and at ease. I could talk to people, and it was just great stuff. And it wasn't a problem for a while, you know. I got out of high school and went to work pumping gas in the Blue Star Cafe gas station, and had a 35 Ford coupe, you know, and a pair of engineer boots, all the gas I could steal, and get drunk on Saturday night, you know, and throw up a lot and have a good time. And life was going along swimmingly, as they say. Then in 1952, I got polio and spent a lot of time in hospitals recovering from that disease. And it was there that I began drinking alcohol to take the rough edges off of life. And I used to have a guy smuggle alcohol into the hospital, and we used to call him Pinky, because I don't know why we called him Pinky. He had a green tongue. His guy was drunk all the time, and he used to hide his drunkenness by eating Clorets by the box. And those poor nuns that ran that hospital couldn't tell you were drunk unless you were prone on the floor, you know. And they wondered how I got drunk in the hospital. I couldn't even get up out of bed, you know. And they wondered how I got drunk in the hospital without a prescription, you know. And followed out eventually, and began working heavy equipment, and eventually got the state of Iowa to pay for some college education. And that was a bit of a disaster. I went to college in a small private school in eastern Iowa, and immediately found alcohol in the bars nearby and began drinking and having a hell of a good time, I thought, you know. And it wasn't a problem. The grades were never too good, and I noticed after a year or so of drinking practically every night in the bars around there that I was having some little nervousness in the morning, you know, and nothing serious. But as time went by, I began showing my resistance to authority a little bit more, and I started writing a column for the school newspaper in my third year. And the column was an upbeat, you know, young... In those days, you know, we didn't have hippies yet, and it was too late for the bohemian era. We just walked around dirty and unkempt and unshaven and mumbled imponderables to each other. And this column in the school newspaper was entitled Ad Nauseam. I'll tell you how really upbeat I was. Well, I was writing things in that paper that got me very, very crossways with the... administration. I wrote things like, education is the inculcation of the incomprehensible into the incorrigible by the incompetent. And 3 years was all they could take of me. And I was drinking, by the end of the third year, I was drinking every night in the bars and most of the time closing the bars. And so it was time to move on, you know. One of the professors, a political science professor, told me one time, he said, you have a weird sort of linear way of thinking. He said, why don't you study law? So he directed me to a place in Omaha, Nebraska called Creighton University, and I went over there to study law with the Jesuit fathers. And I'll tell you, I shaped up for about 8 weeks. And I studied the cases, I briefed the cases, I recited the cases, I looked and acted like a miniature lawyer, you know, and it was going great until the results came back on the first couple of quizzes, and I didn't get very good grades. And there was some good competition, some very sharp young people over there, and I said, to hell with us. If you got a little perfectionism in your life like I have, and we don't do perfectly, screw it. Who needs this? They want to turn out these little cookie-cutter corporation lawyers. They don't want really independent thinkers, right? So to hell with these people. I went back to the bars. And in about a year and a half, I drank my way out of that school. Clear out. And they were better for that, I think. I ended up going to New York and spending some time in New York, and I finally ended up at the University of South Dakota. Not a Big Ten school, exactly. Those of us who love it, even though it is a small school. But it was a perfect place for a drunk, and by this time I was, by anybody's standards, a full-blown alcoholic. And I went to class when I felt like it. I drank every day and every night in the bars around there. And I did wonderful things. I'll tell you about my lighter fluid trick. I like to talk about it a lot because I don't want to ever have to do it again. I used to go to a bar, preferably a bar that I wasn't well known in. And maybe if there was a new bartender, the trick would be even funnier. You go in there and you bring with you a concealed can of lighter fluid, and then you order a shot of dry gin. And when the bartender isn't looking, you drink the dry gin and put the empty shot glass on the bar and fill it with lighter fluid, and then you call a guy over and you say, "What in the hell is this stuff? Jesus, it's volatile, it smells terrible, and it looks like it might even light." And then you take a big drink of this stuff, and you don't swallow it, hopefully. And you light a match, and then you atomize the lighter fluid past the flame. It makes a huge explosion about 15 feet across the bar. And I used to just, it was worth $1 million to me to just watch the expression on people's faces. People go, "Shoot, did that guy belch fire?" I was doing that in the bar in Sioux City one night about 2 o'clock in the morning. In fact, I'd been doing it all afternoon. And most of the surprise was off of it after about 25 times. And about 2 a.m., I had long since dispensed with the shot glass. I'm drinking right out of the lighter fluid can. The lighter fluid's running down my chin, dripping off my shirt, off my elbow. When I lit the match this time, I blew up like a Roman candle. Well, this is way before Richard Pryor came along, you know. we thought free base in those days was a baseball term. Anyway, back in the hospital, my friend Phil O'Brien and I were sitting on the edge of this bed, you know, and we were having a couple of cold cans of Budweiser, and I've got second and third degree burns, and I've got bandages all over my face and hands, and I'm drinking this Budweiser through the bandages on my face, and we're laughing about what a good time we had that night. You know? I'm glad I'm here. I don't think my body would tolerate much more fun out there. So I got out of that law school in 1961 and got licensed to practice in Iowa and started practicing in Iowa for a real estate firm that did abstracts of title, which will Z anybody out. And I did that for about 6 months, and my eyes, I started wearing thicker glasses, you know. Jesus. So I got involved in politics in the election when Kennedy brothers were running, John Kennedy was running for president. And he got elected. He appointed his younger brother Bobby to be Attorney General of the United States, saying that Bobby needed some practical experience before he went out into the private practice of law, so he made him Attorney General of the United States. Robert appointed me to be assistant U.S. District Attorney for my area, and I became a big shot federal prosecutor at age 27. And I was drunk all the time. And, I always believed somehow that if I got this big job or met her or got to this particular location, things would be okay, but it wasn't okay. I was still drinking all the time. I still walked around with a headache and diarrhea all day long when I wasn't drinking. And I was sick a lot. I was sick a lot from alcoholism. I didn't realize that for many, many years, but I worked hard. I prosecuted people for violating the federal liquor laws in the daytime, and then I violated the federal liquor laws in the nighttime, giving a new dimension to the word hypocrisy. But, you know, my life was, I was always believing that it was going to be better if I got somewhere else. Where I was never any good. And so in 1964, I got married in June, and I decided to run for the state legislature. So I got on the ballot and started campaigning in the bars, as God intended. And it was 1964 when Goldwater and Johnson were running against each other at the top of the ticket. I'm a Democrat, one of the few that were admitted in California. But, well, maybe not now after the Iran deal. Anyway, I was on the ballot, and it was 1964, and the Democrats won by a huge landslide. Johnson was swept into office by a very, very large landslide, carrying himself and a lot of other incompetence into office, including me. And that's important to my alcohol story because I went to Des Moines, naturally, to serve in the legislature and met the governor of the state, who happened to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. And we got well acquainted. And, you know, I've spoken to a man a number of times about his alcoholism. Harold H. is his name. And I can remember talking to him about... saying, why the hell couldn't you have a little beer here? Beer is really not too big a deal, you know. And Harold was a combat infantryman and ranger in Second World War. Kind of a mean dude, actually. And he said, well, I could have a beer, sure. I could have a bottle of beer, and then I'd have a quart, and then I'd have a gallon. And when I had the gallon, I'd take this goddamn place apart. That was Harold's method of expressing his exuberance as a thinking man. But I spoke to him many times about alcoholism, and the message for me today is that it doesn't make a damn, you know, if you're really not ready. I wasn't ready. I couldn't connect his problem with alcoholism with my problem of drinking. I didn't think I had a problem with drinking. Not long after that, a guy came to see me who thought I had a problem with drinking. He was a fellow from my hometown, and he came down with no apparent business and walked in and said, you know, I quit drinking. I said, that's great. That's wonderful. In your case, you should have stopped drinking. And he said, well, I haven't had a drink for, I forget how long he said now, but he said, I belong to this organization, people that... we just don't drink a day at a time, and we have this list of 20 questions that we use to determine whether or not you qualify for membership in our group. He handed me a copy of the 20 questions of Alcoholics Anonymous, not AA, but 20 questions of the Johns Hopkins Hospital that were floating around those days. And I looked at it, and the bottom line, we might have been drunk, but we weren't stupid. I looked at the bottom line first. And it said, if you can answer any three of these yes, you are definitely an alcoholic. I wasn't ready to be definitely an alcoholic. So I said, well, you know, I could answer that first one yes. Drinking does make my home life a little unhappy once in a while. What I didn't tell him was that I was never home. And that when I was home, I was very sensitive, and I needed my rest on Saturday morning. And if the cat walked across the carpeting, I might have to chastise him for making a lot of noise, you know. I kept that 20 questions. I kept that 20 questions for a long time. I think I still have it. And it was the very first seed that was planted in my mind about possibly maybe I had a drinking problem. And so when things were going wrong downhill, as they will for alcoholics who keep on drinking, and in 1968 I had left the legislature and I had gone to lobbying for an organization of people that wanted to pass certain legislation, and I was drinking all the time. Lobbyists party for a living, essentially, and I was doing that, and I ended up in the Mayo Clinic without much warning. I was having hypoglycemia, and you know, I was noticing things out of the corner of my eye that weren't there when you would turn suddenly, and I was graying out in the daytime when I hadn't even been drinking, you know. And the doctors locally said, we don't know what's wrong with you. So they sent me up to the Mayo Clinic, and you know, we're slick, we're very, very, very cunning sometimes, and I paid those people $800 to find out what was wrong with me, and I outsmarted them, you know. The first question they asked me, I lied to them. The guy said, do you drink a lot? I said, well, I have an occasional social drink. And I was waiting for him to ask the next most obvious question, like, you know, how close together are the occasions and how big is the drink? You know, never did. And so I went through this huge battery of tests and psychological tests, all kinds of tests. And they were puzzled, you know. Apparently, I learned later that doctors actually rely on what we tell them, in part, to make their diagnosis. They call it a history. And I heard lately that that the doctors have said they have a new way of determining whether an alcoholic is lying or not. The doctor says, you just watch their lips. If their lips are moving, they are lying. But they gave me a diagnosis that they would not have given today, I don't think. I believe that they would have picked up on the alcoholism today. That's my hope, at least. They said, we think you have executive stress syndrome. And if you'll take some of these yellow pills, you know, 5 milligram pills, 4 times a day or whatever. I don't remember the dosage now. And if things really get stressful for you, you take these blue pills, 10 milligrams. You know, in those days they really did believe that alcoholism was a Valium deficiency, I think. But I took the damn pills and I took them as prescribed, you know. Really goofy thing to do. But I took them as prescribed, and I felt very serene on occasions. Some occasions I couldn't hit my rear end with either hand, but I felt very serene. And but when I wasn't taking the pills, I was very anxious. And I ended up in the hospital for 7 days for anxiety, you know, not long after that. And I know today that I was in the hospital because I was withdrawing from alcohol and Valium. You know, I had sworn off forever one weekend. And it was a mess. It was starting to become very, very unfunny. And then in 1968, my wife was killed in an automobile accident. And I had a perfect reason then to drink, and I took a lot of advantage of that. I spent as much time as I could in the bars. I brought my elderly mother down to Des Moines from Sioux City, and she took care of my kid, and I drank. That's what I did for a living for a while. And Jesus, I don't have a lot of recollection of those times, but I know eventually I came around to the conclusion, which we do with keen alcoholic penetrating analysis, I came around to the conclusion that my troubles had all occurred in Iowa. I think I'm in the right place. The answer is obvious. Get out of Iowa. So I convinced my elderly mother that it was going to be better in California. And so we moved up here to Ojai in 1969. And God, it was great. It's a beautiful place, you know, and it's absolutely, there's a lot of excitement about
being in a whole new state, didn't know anybody out here. And I went down in town and looked at this town, and God, it's great. They had this place called a Firebird Tavern. So I went to the Firebird Tavern for a bottle of beer, you know, and I spent 3 years there. During that time, I got licensed out here to practice law, and I started practicing law in a little frame house in Ventura, doing a lot of criminal defense work. I've been a trial lawyer most of my practicing life, and I did a lot of criminal defense work. And I started doing okay on the outside, but on the inside, I was going right down the chute. I was having spiritual awakenings. I like to remember these spiritual experiences that I've had. Wake up in the morning, see this writing right in front of your face. And, you know, it wasn't a biblical writing. It said, Louisiana Desk Company. I was sleeping under my desk again. Lying on my back, fully clothed, suit, tie, you know, all wrinkled and sweaty. And, you know, I'd crawled in there late at night because I was afraid to drive on the freeway. See, I had spent sometimes weeks at a time cruelly grilling some highway patrolman on the witness stand, right? How'd you like to run into a guy you've been humiliating for days on end out there on the freeway, dark place on the freeway, right? Okay, leave the crutches in the car and do the leg raise, okay? Can't do it, huh? Yeah. 23-152A for you, Charlie. Yeah. So I slept in their office a lot. And one day I crawled off under that desk and picked up the Ventura paper, and there was an article in there about this retreat house in Malibu called the Sarah Retreat House, which had burned down in the fire of 70, I think. And there was a little article that said this retreat house was going to start giving retreats again, and you could call a certain number and they would arrange for you to come down. So I called the place, and the lady looked at her calendar apparently and said, well, we're having one this weekend, but the one this weekend is for alcoholics. And got a silence on my other phone. I said, well, I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll come anyway. So I came down and didn't see any alcoholics at the retreat. You know, there were a bunch of guys that were from the valley and other exotic places. And they were having an AA men's stag retreat up on the hill up behind Malibu. And I stayed for the meetings. I was very uncomfortable being around these people who seemed to be happy and comfortable. And I've never heard men talking the way these guys talked. You know, they were telling how they actually felt. You know, feelings. They were actually expressing their feelings. And I could intellectualize about feelings. I could describe feelings. But I sure say I never shared with anybody how I felt. And they talked about, you know, little things like geographical cures for alcoholism. They talked about blackouts. You know, walking around, driving a car, flying an airplane without any recollection of doing those things behind alcohol. And I really could relate to what they were saying. And when it came my turn, I raised my hand and said, I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I believed it, but I said it. And when I said it, it made me feel a little bit like, well, Jesus, you've done something now. You know, you may not be able to go back from this one, you know. But after the meeting, they talked to me practically all night long, some of these guys, and they knew that I was just testing the temperature of the water. And one of these guys, looking right through me, said, well, you may do some more drinking, but we have screwed it up so we won't enjoy it anymore. And he was right about that. I went back to Ventura and picked up that bottle again and started down that short chute. And I got real sick. I got to the point where, you know, where we get pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And You know, you can't drink and you can't not drink. It's a hell of a place to be. And so I called a guy on the program up there and said, I might have a little problem with alcohol. Bob was his name, and he said, well, you could go to the meetings, and I would suggest if you want to be sober, you go to the meetings, go to a lot of meetings, and you could start your day. They have a meeting at 3 o'clock at the Norman and Cooper Manor in Oxnard. There aren't too many people in here that have seen some people in here who would remember that place. It was not a fancy running out place by any stretch of the imagination. But I said, 3 o'clock today? And he said, yeah, today. Jesus, that seems a little soon to me. I thought maybe a week from Monday if I had a little space on my calendar. But I went over there, and you've heard this 1,000 times in AA probably, but it was very typical of what I have heard. It's an old beat-up place, and guys are sitting around a scarred table, one bare fly-specked light bulb hanging down from the ceiling, and they're having an AA meeting, like, you know, the 12 apostles or somebody. And the guy is saying, if you want what we have, you know, Jesus. I thought, you know, if I can get out of here in a minute, I'll get what he has. So my newly acquired sponsor said, when I went back shaking my head, you know, saying, I really don't know about these people, but he said, well, I'm meeting some Beverly Hills for big shots. So I went directly to Beverly Hills. Over here on Rodeo Drive. People that named that street have never been to a rodeo, apparently. Anyway, outside of the meeting, they had these Mercedes-Benzes and these Maseratis and these Rolls-Royces, and I knew they had what I wanted and would go to any length to get. But I went to the meeting, and to be serious about it, I was really moved by the way the people treated me there. They seemed genuinely glad to see me. And they didn't give me a hard time. They didn't ask me if I had any degrees. They didn't ask me if I had wanted to join a committee or pay some money to get a certificate of membership. They didn't give a damn where I had been. They just said, you know, come in, sit down, and have a cup of coffee. And I went to the meetings down there quite a bit. And kept on drinking because I didn't really have a problem with alcohol. I met a lady at one of those meetings, and we met on September 10, 1971. We were married December 3rd, 1971, against the advice of a lot of people. And with one very recent and very painful interruption of about 4 months last year, we've been married for 15 years. And if I have a minute, I'll talk about that a little more. But Mary and I moved up to, she moved up to Ojai where I lived, and brought her two kids, and I had this little girl from a previous marriage, and we jammed those kids together, and we're going to force them into becoming the Brady Bunch, kind of, and they wouldn't fit, they wouldn't be forced. And we had some real rough years. But we went to a lot of AA meetings. And I would go, 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk. And I somehow had the idea from going to the meetings that this was a do-it-yourself program, that you had to actually maintain your own sobriety. It was really, underneath everything, a willpower trip. I hadn't heard the word surrender, and I hadn't heard the first step. You know, I hadn't certainly taken it, and but, you know, we're hard to convince. I'm hard to convince. I can speak only for me. About 8 months of that, you know, going in and out and in and out and in and out. Finally, one day I went into the Firebird Tavern in Ojai and had a bottle of Budweiser, and ordered another bottle and poured a glass out of that second bottle and drank it and walked out of the place, left that rest of that bottle of beer sitting on the bar. That was the 30th of March, 1972, and I haven't had any alcohol in my system since that time. And, that's just a flat miracle for me. Because on my own, there isn't any will for me to be sober. There's no reason for me to be sober, left to my own devices. And, my life cleared up right away. I got rich and famous and serene. And it's been wonderful ever since. And I think I'll go home now. Well, that's bullshit. I had a terrible time. I got sober and I got depressed. I used to sit in the big chair and look at my neighbor weekend after weekend, you know. And because the only thing that ever made me really feel good was going out of my life. And I had fallen in among a bunch of purists in AA who said, you can't even take the little blue ones and the little yellow ones anymore. And I'm almost embarrassed in this group to admit it, but I've never smoked even a marijuana cigarette.
Mercy me.
Well, we were so goddamn dumb back in Iowa. We were surrounded by marijuana, believe it or not. I mean, I like to attribute virtue to it, but it's just stupidity. We didn't know we were in paradise, surrounded by acres and acres of marijuana back there. That's no rib. They were growing it for some wartime purpose, I guess, you know, back in the 40s, you know. And we tripped gaily through the marijuana patch to get to the bar, you know. So, Jesus. But, my God. Well, I started, going to meetings and trudging the road, and people started encouraging me to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I had no trouble with lip service to the steps. They were read at every meeting. But when it got down to things like, actually writing a fearless and searching moral inventory, I wasn't terrified of that. I mean, I was afraid of not making a perfect one because one of my character defects is perfectionism. But you see, I didn't have too much of a problem with a fourth step because I was never going to share it with anybody. And it won't be a problem for you writing all this stuff down if you know you're never going to tell anybody else about it. So it wasn't until I got to the point after doing the four steps that I was, I was absolutely, totally crazy and I was going to take a drink for sure, that I was willing to share the fifth step with another human being and go on and take the rest of the steps through 12. And I got a lot of relief. I didn't feel, it wasn't like the clean wind of a mountaintop blowing through and through like you may have read in the books, but it was enough to reduce the level of conflict in me to the point where I could live another day on the planet without alcohol. And, that's how it started. It's been a fantastic journey. I can tell you honestly that I've experienced more pain in sobriety than I ever did in the years that I drank. I mean, I wouldn't allow myself to experience any pain when I was drinking. My God, that's what drinking is for. the elimination of pain and the elimination of growth for me. But, I went along in this outside business of practicing law, and I did all right, I ran with murderers and rapists and robbers and had a good time, but all the years that I practiced and spent in those courtrooms, I noticed there was only one dude in there that seemed not to be working, and that was his honor. And I've always been looking for an easier, softer way, so in 1982 I applied for appointment to the Superior Court in my county, and I was appointed to the bench in 1983, and I've been there ever since. And that's a big deal, but it's not the biggest deal in my life. It's what I do. It isn't what defines me. It's what I do for a living. But I want to share some of that with you because it's a perspective that you may not hear too often. I spent a lot of time in juvenile court, in the dependency court, which is where children are brought when they are sexually abused, battered, molested, abandoned, neglected by their parents. And we see about an 85%, 85% of the kids at least are the children of alcoholics and addicts. And so I've had a lot of experience lately with a side of alcoholism we don't talk about much. But let me say this, that there's even hope in that area, because I've seen some real miracles of recovery in the programs of AA and NA through those horrible encounters that people have with the law, based on having their children temporarily and sometimes permanently removed from their custody. I want to share this one with you because I think it's funny. A couple of years ago, there was a guy in court, and he was in what we call a little mild denial. And they kept imposing more and more punishment on him until, to induce a state of surrender in him. And one day in court, he said, okay, God damn it, I give up. And I said, that's the first step. And the guy actually did surrender that day. He's been sober since that time. And I see him in the meetings, and he always says, I give up. And then, that's beautiful. The red light is on. My time is up. I love you all. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here.